welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who, if he had a Mogwai, he would purposely feed him after midnight, John Levengood.
But hold on, we've talked about this. Aren't you technically always feeding a Mogwai after midnight?
Because it's always midnight somewhere?
Well, no, because it's always after the last midnight.
Is this a Jimmy Buffett song?
That sounds like it's always after the last midnight.
No, but like, I think you would. I'd be like, hey, Mogwai, you don't have Gizmo. You would name yours like Efron or something like that. But hey, come here. And you would give him like a hoagie after midnight, and he would just spew gremlins so you could battle him in your kitchen.
I would be selling him like a damn chinchilla farm.
That would cause the apocalypse.
No, man. Well, maybe I'd be focusing on just getting like, not feeding after midnight. I'd focus on getting Mogwais wet so I could have a Mogwai farm and sell cute pets. The feeding after midnight, that's on everybody else.
Wait, but if you get a Mogwai wet, don't
I get
they
more
make...
Mogwais?
Wait, then how do you get gremlins?
By feeding them after midnight.
Oh.
So I'm saying I wouldn't feed them after midnight. Instead, I'd just get some Mogwais wet so I could have a Mogwai pet farm.
You just have an adorable farm.
Yeah, adorable. The problem, they do need to eat, though, and I guess that's tough. Like, I want to know the chronological physics of when you can feed a Mogwai.
Wherever they're at, if it's midnight, don't feed them after that. Boom.
But, isn't 11:59 just 23 hours and 59 minutes after the last midnight?
If a bird landed with all the Mogwais, would they eat it?
Well, I think they'd have an added incentive if it was, air quotes, after midnight.
I think either way, it's apocalypse.
I mean, so I just watched this with my very, very young nieces, but with my 3.5 and 5-year-old nieces last week, Gremlins. And it occurs to me that I guess I always remembered this, but not quite the level of menace. Those little Mogwai were extremely dedicated to fooling Billy into feeding them after midnight because they had the wisdom to chew his alarm clock at 11:20 something so that he wouldn't know when it was past midnight, which means that those brand new Mogwai who were invented out of Gizmo's popplebac that same day had already the intuition to know that if they were fed after a certain time on a clock, they would turn into gremlins.
If I was an adorable Mogwai, I would not want to turn into a gremlin.
They were hellbent on it. I mean, Gizmo wasn't. Maybe it's kind of, you know how like the copy of the copy is a little off, even like in the movie Duplicity with Michael Keaton?
Wait, Multiplicity. Duplicity is the Clive Owen, Julia
You're right,
Roberts.
Yeah, Multiplicity. But the copy of the copy is a little off, right? Well, maybe because Those Mogwai that came out of Gizmo's back when he got wet were copies of Gizmo. They were all a little off in the sense of morally off.
So
and that's why
your Mogwai farm is danger then.
Well, it'll be a controlled setting.
Are you hosing Mogwais down?
Whoa, hold on. This is not like a prison camp. I'm not hosing them down for lice or something.
How do you get some little gremlins wet?
I think that I will give them a gentle wash.
Like one at a time?
Maybe.
Sounds like a lot of work. Build them a water park.
Now that's Armageddon. You just, especially if you have a water park and they serve corn dogs, it's Armageddon.
I'd be like Tribbles from Star Trek. It would just keep popping up everywhere.
They'll go down water slides late at night, eat a corn dog, and you'll have Gremlageddon.
So a tiny Mogwai eating a full-size corn dog on a tiny slide. It's adorable.
And world-ending.
Yeah. It's like I think that's the cutest way the world could end.
Well, I don't know. Those gremlins don't look cute when they're, like, slimy coming out of their, like, alien ripoff cocoons.
No, like Mogwais, though. They're cute.
They are cute.
All right, so
even the evil ones.
Moving forward, in the words of John Lazavath, I think we have some listener questions.
We've got a few. First question comes from Movie Graveyard, who on Twitter you can find as @80SMVE Graveyard, as an 80s movie graveyard. They ask, Would the Toxic Avenger be immune to 1985's The Stuff if he ate it?
Yes.
So you say yes. And for those listeners who aren't totally on point, The Stuff is kind of like The Blob, except it's an alien substance masquerading as a mainstream dessert here on Earth. And when people eat it, it kind of takes over their minds as a hive mind for their alien cause. I guess it's like They Live if you were a hive mind ooze.
Like, if an alien ate the stuff, that stuff would have no chance inside the alien.
You mean like a xenomorph? Yeah, from like H.R. Geiger xenomorph? Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe it would be fine.
I don't think it would.
No? See, so Toxic Avenger, right? He was dipped in toxic waste and it somehow mutated him into some really tough, bigger, you know, mesomorphic form of his skinny janitor self, right? But it didn't really change his digestive system that I could infer. He had the same mind. He was still the same mentality person. And the stuff, when you eat it, it then affects your brain. So I guess the question is, one, I think it could affect his brain, but can it survive the toxic environment of his body?
So it would just be like drinking like four shots of vodka immediately.
Or four loco.
Yeah, or drinking two four locos back to back. Like, you're going to be messed up for a while, but eventually your body's going to fight it, you know, probably lose some years off its life, and then expel it and you're back to normal.
It could be. It's like he'll start to be possessed by it and be like, yo, someone who isn't Toxic Avenger, you should also try this dessert-like substance that may or may not take you over. And then right before they're going to eat it, he's like, wait a minute. Nope, I just digested it and my toxicity. And he slaps it out of their hand. I'm totally word vomiting.
Whenever I think about Four Loko, I think about indie kids dancing. Because I was a bouncer at a bar for years. And it was like an indie bar. And we sold Four Loko. And the kids would just get that little Four Loko and they'd be dancing to like Hot Hot Heat and The Killers all night. And I saw at least seven explode.
Four Loko is basically alcoholic, caffeinated The Stuff.
Yeah, it makes indie kids dance. But no, all right, I don't think so, man. I think he would just drink it. I think it would be like a bad burrito.
Like, he wouldn't survive in his system.
Well, I think he would have some rough moments. I wouldn't want to be next to him.
Like, there was a time, though, when Toxie grabs a guy on the forearm and you hear a tss, like the toxic was like eating away at the guy's skin. So it's like, is it that way on his internal organs too? Like, yeah, maybe he just like simmers like a poached egg the stuff when he eats it, and the stuff just dies.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Okay, so movie graveyard sounds like you're gonna have a poached The Stuff.
Yeah, that should be a great movie. Toxic Avenger versus The Stuff.
It's just him like drinking Pepto.
Hey, can you go get the stuff? What stuff? The stuff.
The stuff.
What stuff? That stuff. Where? There.
All right, I got one more question. This question comes from New York City from Josh and Liz, who are the hosts of the Bloody Date Night podcast. I actually heard them do their episode on The Thing recently. It's their last episode, and it actually reminded me of listening to you bicker a bit with your wife watching The Thing. It was very much like that, because I could tell that the guy was all in the whole way through and he had made her watch this great film, which I acknowledge is a great film, and his wife acknowledged in many respects it was a great film. It was just a funny experience. But so Josh and Liz, their question: which horror film villain would you most want to have dinner with, and what would you eat?
Hannibal Lecter.
Obvious choice. Okay, so what would you
have
eat?
You seen Hannibal, the TV show?
No, I've never seen the show.
Oh my goodness, this YouTube Hannibal TV show cooking a meal. The only caveat is I would have to be in the kitchen with him, right?
Because
who knows? Because he's cooking human parts and he's serving it to people. And
you just want to make sure it's cooked appropriately, like it's not too rare.
You know what? I mean, no one ever gets sick from the movies, like the food he's making. I mean, it's the production value in that show is incredible. Or, you know, like if – so that's TV. Or if the movie, I would just like – he would be on one side of the cage eating, you know, fava beans and some wine just because I think that's funny. And then I'll be on the other side probably eating like – what am I feeling right now? you know, good curry, good chicken curry. And he just kind of tries to harass me for 2 hours and tries to get in my head. And I just kind of listen to him and go, yeah, yeah.
Dude, that guy's going to get in your head like the stuff.
Nah, not while I'm eating curry.
That's good. Your stomach's going to be a little too, like, unnerving for him to get in your head.
Yeah, you know, I'll just kind of like, you know, because, all right, Jason Voorhees, he wouldn't talk. Freddy is just a gross human being. Jigsaw would be too preachy. Oh, so tell me about the bad things you did. Why? No reason.
You need to learn to appreciate that curry.
How much did you tip? I tipped 20%, Jigsaw. Don't put me in a trap.
You should have tipped 22%, or perhaps you weren't confident in your decision in your life.
Fooled you. I knew you'd do it. I tipped 25%. I'm building you a trap.
Crap.
And then he's like, I'll build you a trap. I'm like, I'm going to build you a trap. He's like, I'm going to build you a trap. I'm gonna build you one.
And I'm like, so wait. You were saying like Freddy is too gross?
He's a stupid human child murderer, gross person. I don't want to sit next to him. I don't want to listen to his bits. I don't want to listen to his jokes, one-liners, puns. What a douche.
He was my pick.
I love him.
No, hold on. So I would want to eat with Freddy specifically from like Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4, which for any listeners who are trying to get that jumble of sequels in their head, that was it's the Dream Master.
Oh.
And it's the one where at one point he's at a cafe with Alice and he orders a pizza and it has meatballs that have the faces of screaming souls that he's taken on them. And he like sticks it with his index finger blade. And like he takes a bite out of the meatball, which is basically the soul's head. But the reason is because when you get to part four specifically, Freddy is basically pure amusement. Like there are hardly even attempts at jump scares. The things that are scary are the gruesomeness. And occasionally he flips on his malevolent switch from humor. But he's really just in entertaining mode rather than like scary mode. Oh. And so because of that, it makes me wonder, like, he's there trying to get, as the premise of this movie, the last of the Elm kids, right? So, but he's laughing all the time now. This doesn't feel like it's proper revenge. So you know what? I want to sit with him over some soul meatball pizza and actually pick his crispy fried brain over how it is that he's still on a revenge kick when he's basically just laughing the whole time through the movie.
I want to fistfight Freddy Krueger.
Well, but I'm just, he deserves it. He deserves to lose, I should say. But it's like, I get his revenge in all the other movies, even though he's an evil child, whatever, but I understand his revenge, but once you start laughing about it just all the time, it doesn't feel like you're vengeful anymore. So I figured that over the course of a dinner of some human soul pizza, we would be able to pick away the loose chicken fried skin that covers his brain and figure out what's going on under all that.
I would tell him to get over himself.
Well, he definitely does become more prima donna.
He's already calling himself the Dream Master.
Well, I don't think he called himself that.
He put it in everyone's heads. It's a deleted scene. Deleted scene.
That's fair.
All right, so the answer is Hannibal Lecter can't turn you into one of his minions if you're eating curry.
Is it because Hannibal Lecter is made of the stuff?
I think the stuff would get sick of him. You know what I mean?
What if he's like the stuff hive mother?
So he's just,
like, he is the stuff.
But he hates curry?
The curry is also the stuff.
So I'm eating the stuff?
Maybe.
This is blowing my mind.
It's exactly what the stuff wants you to think.
You know, I want some curry. I wish I lived in England right now, because they're always like, yeah, I'm going to go to the curry shop. I live in the suburbs. I got Stop Bop Go, though, next to me. That's a good Korean restaurant. All right.
Get your kimchi fix.
That's right. Hey, thank you all for those questions. Keep them coming. We appreciate every single one of them. Y'all are great. And without your questions, our show would be shorter. So, and less entertaining. So thank you very much. John. This is a big podcast for us.
It's moderate. Yeah, I'm really proud of our year-end podcast. They really force us to do a lot of reflecting.
I mean, a lot of reflecting.
I mean, it's not the year end, but it's like the our last month we do a lot of reflective podcasts.
I've been doing a lot of punch dancing in abandoned warehouses just to mentally prepare myself for this.
I was focusing on my Untappd app and keeping track of beers I was drinking.
Yeah, see, I had to punch dance off all the beers, you know. But so this is big. We're gonna go over, you and I each have put together five horror films each, and we're going to go over the best horror films of 2017. And I think this one is probably one of our most comprehensive because, I mean, you've watched a decent amount of horror films. I've been on like a crazy tear lately.
So, and, you know, this year's interesting to me because this year I watched fewer movies than I have in any other year since we started all this, and concurrently less horror. And in my opinion, this wasn't as nearly great a year for horror as any of the last two or three years, on top of me not seeing nearly as many movies. What is your personal take of this year's horror?
I think it was a great year for horror. I think It and Get Out and Annabelle Creation and Split were massive hits. I think they really helped the mainstream learn, like, hey, these movies can be good. There were four. Well, and Happy Death Day. There was five good mainstream horror films that audiences really embraced, and so did critics. And also on the other side, I think there were some really great – oh, Get Out as well. I think there were some very good indies that really are kind of starting to redefine the genre a little bit. And I like that horror directors are becoming, I think they're freer to make the films they want with so many different avenues. And I think 2017 was a very exciting film just because I've watched a lot of the horror movies. Like I've gone through, you know, Netflix had some great offerings. Then you have the VOD, then you have the theatrical. So I think we're getting good horror films from all angles.
And I think we're getting better mainstream. But I don't know, like the last 2 years, not counting this year, were so spectacular. By the way, I'm not discounting the quality of this year.
Well,
I'm just saying.
But you haven't watched much of them, right?
I don't know. It's hard for me to gauge. I can't even honestly say. It's hard for me to gauge. But the last 2 years, excluding this year, Spring, Hush, Honeymoon, movies like those were coming out that were not things that weren't mainstream though. Like this year seemed to be the breakout year for mainstream horror.
Yeah. I mean, once we start going through this list, I think yours definitely kind of has more of the mainstream, but I included some little buggers on here we can talk about.
Which is funny too, isn't it? What? Me being the mainstream horror all of a sudden.
Yeah. I mean, well, no, you've always like concentrated on what 70s, 80s, 90s, right? But like right? Like you've been kind of.
I like that stuff, and then just the brutal stuff if it's indie, the brutal like the French, or super gory or French, weird yeah. Foreign, right? Yeah, like
Martyrs.
Right, and whereas this year, the indie. It brings up so much mystique when I keep talking around our picks.
Right, so I guess I'll jump us off. And with number five, I kind of cheated. I did six, but I couldn't decide between Creep 2 and The Devil's Candy. We have a Creep podcast before, and we are big fans of that movie. Patrick Bryce, director, Mark Duplass, the star. Creep 2 is better, I believe. I think it elevates the character. It evolves the character, and it's very, very wicked. It's good, and it's funny, and it's mean, and it's balls out, literally.
Literally.
I really don't want to talk about it too much more, but basically the gist is the killer from the creep, Aaron, he's kind of like tired of killing because he's already murdered 39 people. And he hires this woman. She kind of goes to these lonely men's houses to kind of see what's wrong with them and give them attention. She films it. So she goes to his house. He doesn't want to kill anymore, but she kind of pushes him, and it like leads to this pretty brutal and neat conclusion. I would definitely watch Creep 2. And also the one that we both watched is The Devil's Candy. It was directed by Sean Byrne, who also directed The Loved Ones. I mean, this is a guy that definitely knows how to bring the pain. And the Devil's Candy is about a family that moves into a house. The father is in Austin, they're kind of like a blue collar, non-conservative family. The father's an artist. He kind of gets influenced by the devil. He starts churning out this crazy art, whereas Pruitt Taylor Vince is this crazy murderer. And I mean, there's some very brutal moments in this film, but for me, the standout was Ethan Embry. And I actually found out that he lost, 50 pounds to look like an older Kurt Cobain. He'd run 5 miles a day. He burned 3,000 calories, only put 2,000 in. So he lost like a pound every 3 days. And the funny thing is, this art was done by a famous artist. And the artist was like, hey, I don't think I'm going to have it done, so we'll just do reshoots in LA. And Embry's like, no. He's like, I can't maintain this. Like, I'm a rail. Like, give us the paintings. And they got the paintings in the Devil's Candy the night before.
And he was really ripped in that, by the way. That was impressive.
He went on this like crazy diet. And I guess what I like most about this, even Shuri Appleby, she's really good in it as well. Ethan Embry's really good. There's some nasty moments, to be sure. Like, there's some moments where I was like, why am I doing this? Not turning it off, but I mean, some really hard hitting scenes, like involving, you know, child murder. But the heart of it with Ethan Embry and Shuri Appleby, and I really liked his painter character in that he loved his wife. He loved his kid. He really wanted to be there for him. I saw him trying. He had moments where he wasn't there for his kid, and it like broke his heart. So you have these people that you like, and you know, as the action unfolded, it just made it all the more, I don't know, worthwhile.
You know, I feel like Ethan Embry's character, and was Shuri Appleby the daughter?
No, she's the wife.
Oh, okay, but whoever,
she's a Swim fan.
Whoever the daughter was. Now, I mean, all three of them did fantastically together. But when I saw Ethan Embry interacting with the character playing his daughter, or the actress playing his daughter, they had such a deep richness for a familial relationship, a father-daughter relationship. There are very few movies where I saw such a powerful, rich, credible, lived in situation. It made me think actually of 1984's Poltergeist, where I feel like the familial connections were the strongest part of that film and set a strong precedent for horror that is rarely matched. And I felt like they did that. And the other thing is that it almost felt like there was a soft spot for metalheads in this. And I was kind of a bit of a metalhead in high school. And then I kind of became a bubblegum top 10 kind of person. But like, it was a family guy and an artist who just happened to be a metalhead, and they depicted all that very fairly. There were no agendas here other than showing a rich family history that was then plagued with evil.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. Like, the metalhead, he wasn't just like a metalhead. He wasn't a stereotypical guy. Like, he was a sensitive artist dude who just kind of grew up with metal and passed along to his daughter. I think it was almost like a healthy type vibe.
A beautiful connection too, where that was their inside thing, and the mother would roll her eyes at them when they would start headbanging in the car, and actually brought all three of those characters together right away in the movie. Like, I didn't need them explained. I understood.
Like, there was a scene where the daughter and Ethan Embry were, what the hell you call it when they're like putting their headbanging up and down, and the wife, Shirley Appleby, she's kind of like, oh, brother. But then he starts laughing, then they all start laughing about it. So it's
great. He laughs, he looks in the rearview mirror, his daughter laughs. Yeah, it was like, just so warm.
But like, there's, all right, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna give us our PG-13. There's some fucking mean parts in this movie.
Absolutely.
There's very mean parts, and if you're weak of stomach, I wouldn't recommend it, because there's a scene in here where I just went, fuck. Oh wait, no. Are we R now?
It's okay.
No, whatever. I kind of turned away and like did some, like, I just walked away. Not walked away, but I was like, oh man, that's nasty. And so, it is a movie that like wants to hurt you, but you also want to have feelings for it. It's very conflicted, but I don't know. I don't feel that way towards that. And I really, Sean Byrne's really good, very good director, but I think this comes down to Ethan Embry, who also in Cheap Thrills kind of becomes this dirtbag to like the heart and soul of the film. And I mean, if you think about him in other films, That Thing You Do, Empire Records. The guy just has this inherent likability, but he's kind of turned himself into like this like ripped kind of badass. So you have this dude that is physically imposing, but also really nice. And I think that is, I think that really works well in horror, kind of having that heart. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm excited to see what he does next.
Yep. I appreciate that he did this after Late Phases, which felt like a paycheck movie for him.
Yeah,
that is for
yeah,
me.
He was like a spoiled brat son.
Yeah, I loved Late Phases, but yeah. him in it was throwaway.
Yeah.
And there wasn't, and I, yeah, the, this was yeah. this was a good transition.
The writing wasn't very good for that character. He was just the stock kind of douchey son.
Mm-hmm. Ethan Embry, if you're listening, I think you're fantastic. I'm blaming writing, like Mark just said, for Late Phases.
And if you're the writer of Late Phases, I think we both like Late Phases.
Oh, loved it. Just that character. Just that
I just think character. You focus so much on the very good protagonist that you forgot to add some more depth to the son, which is totally natural in a film. You want to have a gruff blind guy battling a werewolf, you know, son's second thought.
So, because it killed his dog primarily.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a better script than I would have written. So, you know, if it would have been like Hank Jablonski, we wouldn't have minded it so much. But it was Ethan Embry after Cheap Thrills.
Hank Jablonski. Well,
yeah, that guy, you know, he can play the jerky son all day.
So my number five, as we work our way down our top five, I'm being a whore for mainstream this year, but I guess it was a good mainstream year. I'm picking Annabelle 2, and it's not because I think it's a great horror film. And in general, I will poo-poo the use of cheap jump scares. However, if you give me a movie that is like 89 loop-de-loops of a roller coaster of jump scares, that is just pure fun to me. It's what Lights Out was last year that I thought was an utter blast. And that's why I thought that this year's Annabelle Creation was a blast. It was 89 loop-de-loops and a roller coaster of jump scares, and it kept you on edge.
I don't want to step on, I don't want to like cut you off, but I think almost sometimes making a very good mainstream horror film might be harder than making a great indie horror film.
But, and you know, and let's be careful. I don't even want to call this a film.
Yeah, no, you know what, though? I think this movie, so The Raid, right, has fantastic action scenes, right? This movie was meant to be not have set pieces that revolved around jump scares. Let's call them jump pieces. This movie was made to be a funhouse. It, for what it is, it excelled at it. And
yes,
you know, and for people who say it's not a film, I get it. You could probably say, hey, this is a movie. But as far as like a technical standpoint of succeeding and coming up with and writing and getting the performances, this was a tough film to make because it came from Annabelle, which was a turd sandwich. So I totally get it. I think this film or movie was very good at what it did. And I loved it. I wish I could have been in a theater for this film. And I just think it was successful at doing jump pieces. Like there were some moments I loved, dude. I was like, oh, and it was mean. There were some mean moments in this movie.
Such a relief too, because the first Annabelle was trying so hard to be taken seriously, and they totally ruined what is a genre that usually does all the work for itself for being creepy. It's an Evil Doll movie. Those movies just work even when they suck normally. And it tried too hard and it just didn't work. And they're like, let's make the priest possessed and ugh. And then this again, like this is where my film movie line gets a little blurred. And it's because like Treat Williams is kind of our main star, one of them, and he felt like a throwaway, and I didn't care much about our characters. But you know what? I loved all the decisions that were made that staged our characters' placement that led to our jump scares.
And Annabelle 2?
Yeah.
Oh, Anthony LaPaglia was...
I'm sorry. I don't know why I said Treat Williams. Yeah. You're right.
And Miranda Anthony LaPaglia. Otto.
They have superficially similar eyebrows. Anthony LaPaglia. Sorry. My bad.
There's a scene where... Like, he's a very nondescript character, but there's a scene where he's holding the cross. I don't care. And Annabelle just kind of looks at him, and his fingers start breaking one by one.
Backwards.
And you're like, oh! So I had contractors coming to my house to work on my home, so I watched it early in the morning because they like said they were going to be late. So I'm like, well, I'll just knock out a quick movie before they're here because I'm going to be home anyway. And I was sitting there at like, you know, 8:30 in the morning just going, what?
on a Wednesday, 8:30 in the morning on a Wednesday, you're watching Annabelle Two like Fingers some, being broken.
Like some time like that. And I was just like, ah, I think that was what it was. But I was just like an early morning Annabelle. And I was like jumping up and down.
Your coffee is still setting into your bloodstream and you're watching Fingers break backwards.
And I'm sitting in my house going, I love this.
But those thrill rides, though, whether or not I agree with the other technical aspects of the film, if a movie has a lot of thrill points in it that are well executed, I don't care, even if it's a lot of jump scares and very deliberately staged dread and scare, I'm very supportive of it. It's not necessarily easy to do. I thought Dead Silence kicked ass at it. That was a James Wan film. And, you know, I love those movies. Sometimes I just want to be purely entertained, and Annabelle 2 kicked butt at that for me.
Like, that's like the date night of the year as far as Dude. Horror films.
Remind our listeners, your first date with your wife was?
Drag Me to Hell.
Yeah.
And then Man on Wire.
This is why we're such good friends.
That's right.
What is your number four as we make the dramatic climb towards our number ones?
So for me, this is the breakout horror hit of the year. But since it's already had so much love, I didn't want to put it at one. And I don't think I would have put it at one. It might be a little higher in the list, but number four is Get Out, directed by Jordan Peele. Of course, it's Blumhouse, who also did like Split, Get Out, Happy Death Day. And what I love about it is Jordan Peele really loves Rosemary's Baby. And I listened to like his two Nerdist episodes. I've done a lot of like reading about what inspired him for this film. And he really loves Rosemary's Baby, Stepford Wives, the 1970s kind of paranoid films that actually kind of had something to say, you know, Night of the Living Dead. And so he took that love of those classic kind of 70s, late 60s, 70s horror films and really translated them perfectly into our 2017 world. And what I like most is it covers a lot of racial issues. It tackles those headlong without being preachy. And I also like how it's a crowd pleaser. Like, this movie in a packed theater would be, people would be going apeshit. So I think he succeeded on many levels with making this kind of paranoid thriller kind of take on race without being preachy, but still making it a crowd pleaser. And I find that to be very impressive from a first time director writer.
Yeah. You know, normally I don't really think twice about spoiling a movie, especially if it's been in a podcast and especially when it's been out for 6 months, but I would not dare say anything to reveal anything about this movie, just because if you haven't seen this movie, go see it. If I spoiled it, it's like Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father. You're going to hate me. Yeah. And,
yeah, there's big twists in it.
And you know, but so Jordan Peele, most listeners should know this by now. He's been doing, he so much press in the last 6 months about this, but he's one of the two writers for Key and Peele, the sketch comedy show. And they were calling this a social thriller as a new kind of subgenre. I think it's just sells headlines, to be honest. I don't disagree or agree, but I actually heard him do two completely different segments on NPR over the last 6 months. And I don't mean one is this is what you did with this movie, and then the next one they reiterated it. I mean, I heard two totally different themed segments that interviewed him about this movie and different aspects of it in the last 6 months on NPR. That's just cool. That doesn't, by the way, folks, I listen to NPR every day in the car on my way to and from work. This is the only horror movie I think all year I've heard discussed on NPR, and I heard it discussed twice.
Yeah.
That's powerful. You know, it's like
that. And then, Jason Blum, I've heard him, like his business model. People kind of love that. Those are like, I don't know. But yeah, so that's my number four.
You might know this offhand because Jason Blum's model is normally $1 million for a first time film maker, isn't it?
He moved up. So some movies like Happy Death Day, I believe, cost 4.5. Then, actually, I looked at all the budgets of his films recently. Split was definitely higher than that.
But he was an established filmmaker.
Yeah, sequels, they bump it up.
Yeah.
I would say they now with, you know, inflation and there are movies that he really backs. I would say they can't go higher than five. No, they probably can't go higher than four. I would say.
If you're like cold call new.
Yeah. And yeah, if you won, then probably. And if you go over, you have to pay for it.
That's good to know. By the way, this is also my number one for the year, this movie, Get Out. Now, you made a political decision, I think, to put it at number four. And I'm just like, you know what? I think this is my number one. It had Bradley Whitford in it. I thought he was fantastic as the dad.
Yeah. I'd vote for Obama three times.
Yeah. I mean, all that kind of well-intended, yet, in my opinion, well-delivered racial tension humor. It always had me a little uncomfortable, but it always had me snickering. I think, man, that I feel like that movie always landed the way that it should have to everyone in the room.
Yeah. And I think it was a very shrewd choice to do like the supposedly well-meaning but ultimately racist or demeaning liberals. Like, so this wasn't like, hey, boy, you know, like, what's going on? Like, it wasn't Southern stereotypes. It wasn't the classic angry racist. Like, he tackled a different kind in this.
It was, I don't even know if I'm using this term correctly, but like the neo-contemporized racist view. Is that, I'm word bombing. You know what? Don't listen to me anymore, folks. But I don't know.
It was just smart. It was a very good way of delivering his message.
I think that's pretty fair. I love the movie. I already bought it, right away. This movie, if you ever plan on watching this movie a second time because you saw it in theaters, just pay for it. This movie deserves that. I think he's doing a series right now. I think he's writing for a series that's a Lovecraftian, like Cthulhu thing. That's, yeah, a period piece.
You're going to love that.
That reflects both the racial tensions of like the 50s to 70s in a backdrop of a Lovecraftian Cthulhu issue. So that was the old talks months ago. I hope that happens. Do you have any other thoughts before I move on to my number four?
Let's do it. Let's go to four.
My number four, and I'm sorry, folks, I'm a total sellout, and you know that my sexuality gets thrown up in the air because we're going to talk about Ryan Reynolds and life. I'm sorry. That's my biggest man crush. He's even over Zac Efron. Ryan Reynolds is my first man crush. Either way, so Ryan Reynolds is in this. It has, oh my goodness, so many cool actors in this movie. You've got Jake Gyllenhaal in here. We have the fellow who was in The Last Samurai and I think Extant.
And he was in
Sunrise.
And he was in, yep, Sunrise.
Rebecca
Ferguson.
Who was in, she was in a Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, is that right?
Yep.
Or Rogue Nation.
Rogue Nation.
I mean, powerful cast. You know, a lot of people give this movie flack. This is another movie that I call a thrill ride. It relied on jumpy scares and very, very deliberately staged dreadin' scares. But I thought that they were all very well executed. And that, again, it was 89 loop-de-loops on a roller coaster. Raw entertainment. And something that I think that some people slammed when I was reading reviews is that I actually loved these characters. These characters did not develop, but these characters in time, in that short period of time they were dealing with this, I loved their characters. They felt lived in to me, and I appreciated their reflections on how they were before they were on the craft versus while they were on the craft and how they handled the problem. And then I thought that Calvin the Monster was fantastic because it was every bit as animalistic as a xenomorph, but they always called it Calvin. And it was always Calvin that was after them. And Calvin got out. And Calvin's in the air vents. And Calvin must have gotten through the door. It always felt like he is after us, not it. Even though it was really just an it. It was just an animal trying to survive. And I loved all those aspects of the movie. Mark, I'm word vomiting. Jump in. Well, you got to stop.
I like that the director worked with Ryan Reynolds in Safe Haven. I like that the writers, Rhett Reese and, oh man, I wish I remember his name, wrote Deadpool. So this is like a Ryan Reynolds family affair. I also thought it was pretty interesting that the first shot was about 8 minutes. He did a one-er. The director's really obsessed with one-ers. And so when you watch the opening of the film, it's a really choreographed, well-made shot. Also, the film's pretty mean. It has a pretty mean streak to it. Like, people get obliterated in nasty ways. And I don't want to give away the ending. I saw it coming, but...
I love the ending, though.
It's, like, this movie, it looks very good. I'm not, like, combating with you. I don't think I ever really felt for any of the characters, but I like the decisions that they made. I like that the director really wanted to, like, the director was really trying to go for, like, noir type things, and he really put a lot of thought into Calvin. He said if you watch it over and over, or if you watch it multiple times, you'll see different ways that Calvin evolves, and he kind of mimics humans. I also like that the director called Ryan Reynolds his Janet Leigh. Never mind, I don't want to spoil that. Should we spoil it?
Well, we just said that, so you know what, guys? There's a 60-second window for spoiling, so fast forward 60 seconds if you want to skip the spoilers. Go!
3, 2, 1. Ryan Reynolds is the first one to die.
That's okay, though. But you know what else? I liked that he died, and the way he died was brutal. When he twitched in the air after he died, in zero gravity, that was jarring.
And then you want to hear something pretty interesting. Ridley Scott... And so Alien Covenant and this kind of came out in the same time, but Ridley Scott kept moving it. So then Life would have to move because they didn't want to go against Alien Covenant. And the director worked with, I need to find this director's name. I keep saying the director. I know his name. Life director 27. Life director? That's not going to be right. Oh, Daniel Espinosa. He worked with Ridley Scott on Child 44. So they knew each other and they kind of kept moving the movie to,
kind of, to accommodate for that release time.
Well, no, Ridley Scott kept moving it. And so they had to keep moving Life forward. So his production time, his post time got a lot less. And I don't know, I kind of like this. So Daniel met Ridley and he didn't really want to go up to Ridley because he didn't know what Ridley thought. And I thought this was cool. He's like, he's a sir, nobility for real. Then suddenly he sees me and he raises his voice like the general that he is. Daniel, come over here. I walk over him and he says, so when are you releasing your movie? I said, March. And he said, can you make the date? He's looking at me and I said, I'll make the date. Ridley, if you move, then I'll move again. He looks at me and it's almost like we're waiting to draw our guns, you know? Then he smiles and says, make a good movie and then it's going to be all right. And then he hugged me and we walked away each in separate ways. So they were kind of dueling. And the funny thing is, this movie's 67% on RT and Alien Covenant 68. So movies that prove that space exploration is terrible.
I can't believe Covenant is that high.
Yeah, I mean, it just looks good. Same thing happened with Prometheus. But Life, I think it's really well made. I think it's well written. I think it's nasty. I think it has a chance of becoming a cult classic because it's fun. It's a fun – I mean, someone called it like a B-grade movie with A-list talent and sets and writing.
I think that if someone is listening who actually hasn't seen this movie yet – you want to research online and find the very first trailer that ever ran for this movie. And it's one scene and it's people doing a video log, like saying why they're going on this space expedition. And it got cut from the main movie. And it was the scene. I'm talking about Alien Covenant right now.
Yeah. I was like, wait a second.
Because we mentioned Covenant and it got that in my head.
And then these two people get murdered in the shower.
Don't even listen to me, folks. I don't know what I'm – ignore my – I'm giving you my top 87. I don't know what's happening.
All right. So we're going to – let's
start top 5 and 4.
We're going to let John kind of like regroup. We're going to let his synapses spark again here. And we're going to take a break. And we will be back with you after the ads. If the ads haven't been inserted yet, we apologize. We'll be back really quickly. And if they have been inserted by Levengood, you will hear ads. We'll be back soon. Bye.
Cheers.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks, and we'd also like to thank our sponsor who is not our sponsor, Cigar City. What did you just open, John?
That would be a homemade apple pie cider from Cigar City.
Oh, wow, John. Can you tell me more about Cigar City Brewery?
It's pretty damn good, man. I'm not going to lie. This is that cider that people who don't like ciders because they say they're too sweet, well, they still like it because it is just crisp. Cigar City, if you're listening, Movies, Films, and Flicks thanks you.
Hey, John, if I've satiated my thirst for cider and I'm looking for another delicious Cigar City beer, which ones would you recommend?
Well, there's their award-winning brown ale.
A brown ale? Wow.
The Maduro.
What if you're looking for something hoppy?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, you could go light with the, what is it, the Tampa Bay Lager?
Wow.
Or you could go heavy with the High Lie.
Gee whiz.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't. You keep doing this, I can't keep a straight face, man. You are like a 50s commercial Stepford husband.
Well, thank you, Cigar City. And stay doing good work, Cigar City.
Did you know I was going to lose my shit while you were doing that?
No, I didn't, man. It just felt right.
Gotcha. All right.
No, for real, dude. I love Cigar City.
No, I am for real, listeners, enjoying that beer, which is a Tampa Bay area staple.
That's right.
Delicious.
It's swell.
Oh, God, that's good. It's so good. When it hits your lips.
Just, you know what? If you drink 40 of them. Oh, no, I think that's illegal to say. I could get sued. Never mind. I don't want to say.
Drink 4 in one period of time and 4 in 9 other periods of time.
I was about to make an absurd and false and something someone no one should ever do. I was going to say, if you drink 40 of them, you won't be drunk. But don't do that. Don't ever do that.
Sounds dangerous.
Yeah. All right. Let's. I think we have another listener question.
I have one more from a Twitter user who goes by @WeirdNerd42. And WeirdNerd42 asks, why didn't Stephen King's It just crawl up the sewer pipes and kill each member of the Losers Club while they slept?
Because sewer pipes are gross.
They are gross.
Listen, I'll go in a drainage tunnel. I'll kill, you know, if I was a demonic turtle clown, no, a demonic space clown who could be killed by a turtle, I would go in sewer drainage tunnels, but not pipes.
You just gotta watch out for that gray water.
Yeah, I mean, listen, guys, pipes are confusing. Maybe he tried and got lost. Maybe he waited in one toilet for like 6 hours. No one went.
Well, so.
And obviously you could go out of the toilets. I'm doing a bit.
So like in the movie, they at one point mentioned that Pennywise fed on fear.
Yeah.
And then at another point, it was expressed that when a kid verbalized that he had no fear of him and overcame that fear, that Pennywise lost his power. Mm-hmm. And that was realized on screen. And this also happened in the 1990 TV miniseries version. However, there are numerous other times in the movie that don't seem to agree with this narrative at all. So I'm kind of left on the fence to question, did they just poorly execute that aspect of Pennywise, or did Pennywise lie or poorly express the rules that govern his own behavior? Or what? Because sometimes in the movie, it seems like that's perfectly within his range of behavior. And then other times in the movie, they suggest that they need to fear him for him to be able to prey on them.
I just like the kids a lot, so I didn't really care. I didn't care about Pennywise the Clown in this movie. I thought the kids were good performers.
Did you not like the non-scary physical acting?
He was juicy. Like, he always looked like he had, like, wet lips. He was, real, like, real juicy looking.
Probably from a good lip balm.
Yeah, like an intergalactic lip balm. No, I thought the performance was fine. I just never, like, whenever he went off the screen, like, I wanted Stand By Me or, like, the Goonies. I was like, get off the screen, clown.
That clown got a lot of screen time. I will say that. It, yeah. Like I said, 89, like I said earlier, 89 loops in a roller coaster. That was a lot of excitement in that movie, even though some of it was honestly so zany that I can't remember the events in order of the movie, but I remember all the events.
Well, this leads to a good conversation as we can jump into our post. Oh, wait. So why did he not go through drainage pipes? Partly through fear and partly because they were gross.
Sure.
All right, dig it. Now,
I'm actually kind of nonplussed by it because, he wasn't consistent. That was my problem. When you give me a monster that isn't consistent, I can love the movie experience and love the movie, but still be critical of the rules. And the rules were not clear. So I don't – it makes it such that we don't like answering listener questions, but I'm going to call this listener question unanswerable, which is what I asked for.
Hey-o. You were saying like it. I'm trying to picture it in my head as by way of 1, 2, 3, 4, but it's kind of pinballing all over my head. Whereas other movies like The Devil's Candy or ones that'll be featured in this list, I can almost see them in my head block for shot for shot. It's kind of an interesting dynamic.
Right. You know, as it turns out, my number three on our list is the Stephen King's It remake. And as I said before, such an exciting movie. I can remember all the exciting scenes, all the times that monstrous clown hit the screen. I remember. And I loved. I thought they were all fun, even if they weren't all the most tactful. And again, there are certain scenes where I cannot recall the order in which they happened.
He bit a child's arm off.
Now, that was early. That was Georgie.
Poor Georgie.
Oh, God. Now, I love that scene so much. In fact, that might be my favorite scene because he opened his mouth to just an unimaginably cartoonishly huge gaping maw as his eyes rolled back. It showed his monstrosity and it took me off guard. Even though I knew something was going to happen, it took me off guard. And that's why I say I appreciate movies that even when they give you the dread and draw, I appreciate execution.
I mean, this movie made over $400 million worldwide. R-rated movie.
Was that domestic? Oh, you said worldwide. I'm sorry.
International, yeah. That's insane. That doesn't happen.
Do you know its budget?
35?
No. Was that low?
35 to 42, yeah.
That's impressive.
I mean, but the guy who did it was a Guillermo del Toro acolyte. So they know how to keep the budgets low. He did the movie where the lady turns into a plant and then the kid disappears, and I have no way how they're going to explain how the kid turned into a leaf. Mama.
The guy directed, I thought you were talking about the lady in the water.
The guy directed the Mama movie where the kid turned into a leaf with Mama. You know when Child Services comes around, they're going to be like, hey, where's the kid?
Left with that ghost mother.
Yeah, turn into a leaf.
It's like pretty sure that you're going to jail forever, buddy. Yeah. nice story.
I'd be pissed
guy who plays Jamie Lannister.
I'd be pissed at that kid.
I don't know what to say, man. Yeah, Mama left a harsh ending.
But yeah, no, I mean the movie was a massive hit. I loved it. I thought it.
Yeah, it had some very noticeable. I don't know what to call it. It's almost flaws that go back to storyboarding, but I don't care. It was very entertaining, and I'm pretty sure they had a proposed release date for Chapter 2 as soon as Chapter 1 hit the screen.
Yeah, Jessica Chastain was like, I'm in. I'm redheaded. That'd be pretty awesome.
Is she playing the adult now? Well,
She just said, I'm in.
Okay, so, I remember that, but
I mean, I'd like to see where this goes.
Yeah, it's interesting too how they altered the storytelling narrative. I guess it makes a little more sense for movie making, but in the miniseries and in the book, they yo-yo back and forth between the kids as kids and the kids as adults.
Yeah,
it actually starts with them as adults in the book and movie. TV miniseries from 1990, whereas this was just all them as youths. So that means that when they were writing this, they had to go and cookie cutter out all the pieces of them as kids, realize all the narrative that was delivered while they were adults reflecting on their flashbacks and experiences, and create a seamless narrative without the adult exposition, which I don't think is easy. It's almost that notion that sometimes it's easier to start over than it is to rewrite something that is a mess. I'm not saying that the original writing was a mess, but with what they wanted to do, they wanted to restructure it so much. It's like, gosh, if only we could just start over. That must have been such a task. And I'm very happy, though. Very, very happy with what they produced.
Why did it click so
massively?
Why did it click so massively with audiences?
Well, the child actors were amazing. And would it be wrong of me to say that it almost seemed like they were deliberately trying to tap into some of the 80s-ness in a more R-rated sense from Stranger Things?
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of interesting how the lead actors were kids, but it was R. So no kids could really watch it.
I
was like a feral 12-year-old. So, I mean, I would have been in the theater.
The book was an even harder R than the movie.
There's some crazy scenes that they left out. But it's kind of interesting how the movie made so much money and it's a tale about children, but it taps into people our age nostalgia of the miniseries.
Yep. And I'm so happy that they did go R and not PG-13. We're in a good time frame, aren't we, for R-rated action, R-rated horror again. We're kind of in that horror sense, aren't we, in the last like 5-8 years, not even, more like 4 to 6 years. We're in a good revisiting period of horror.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, you kept saying R and it got me thinking about pirates for some reason. I don't know why, but
R!
can I jump into my number three?
You jump in.
Geraldine.
Off the plank.
Oh, wait a minute. Gerald's Game, directed by Mike Flanagan, who did Hush and Oculus. Very, very, very solid up and coming director. I watched this.
And Absentia.
Absentia, yep. And another one of his, Before I Wake, is finally being distributed. So he's very excited about that. And he did a Ouija, Origin of Evil.
Mm-hmm.
And he directed all the Cigar City commercials.
You listening, Cigar City?
Oh, my. So, interesting backstory. Mike Flanagan used to walk around with this hardcover book in his satchel or whatever bag he had. And people would ask, hey, if you could make a movie, what movie would you make? And he would always say Gerald's Game because it was thought to be an unfilmable adaptation. You have one location, woman strapped to a bed. You have inner monologues, you have ghosts, you have potential demonic beings, you have dogs. People are just thinking this cannot happen. This movie is, you know, this is not going to work. But for me, I love this movie. I watched it with my wife. We sat there just absolutely, you know, I think I'd worked a long day. I came home. And normally I kind of fall asleep watching movies, but I stayed – I compliment myself for staying alert. I stayed alert during the whole thing. And as it built, I've been a fan of Carla Gugino's for a while, and I thought she owned this film. I thought, you know, no two camera angles were the same. They had to be creative with all their setups. I liked how it built to the conclusion. It was – I was covering my eyes. I just thought it was a very well-made, small, well-performed, confident horror film, and I liked it. I loved the ending. People had problems with it. I don't want to wreck it, but for me, it's a clear number three.
I agree with basically all your observations. I was less moved by it, but I was very impressed by it. For our listeners, by the way, this was a Netflix original. And so is 1922, which is also
very
Stephen
good.
King.
Yeah, it's Thomas Jane's very good in 1922.
But so this one's a Netflix original. It's, I guess, going to be on Netflix forever, Mark? Is that what that means? Okay. So any of you can listen. You can listen to us on iTunes. You can go see that on Netflix any old time. But I was really impressed with this film. And this was a very filmy film. And I appreciate all the things that you identified about the challenges of making one of these kind of one acts, even though the final fraction of an act is outside of that set. It's like it felt like a one act. It basically was a one act play. And
would you say it's a one act?
It's a one act. It's a single act.
No, it's just funny. You said one act three times in a row.
Gathering my thoughts. It buys me time. Instead of saying, I'm just gathering my thoughts. But, this was really creepy, but this is, for me, the film that I'm more thrilled that someone made than I am thrilled with its quality. And that's not to discount its quality, but it's like, this is not in my top five. This probably wouldn't be in my top eight, but I was very, very impressed with it. If you actually had me rank horror by how impressed with it, it would be in my top five. If you had me rank things by kind of the emotional, pure entertainment response that I normally go on, then it wouldn't be.
I like that Gugino finally had a, I don't know, she's always been the wife or someone kind of in the background. So I was stoked to see her really have a chance to shine. And there's a scene with a handcuff and a cut.
Ooh, and I got to say, and everything that happens in that third act, too, does go into, like, bonkers town fun. Like, fun but creepy as hell.
Bonkers
but,
town.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to say anything about that, the final portion of the final act, but everything that you thought was a little off, like, holy crap, it goes nuts.
Yeah, I loved it. I got chills just thinking about it, dang it. All right. Jump to two. Are we at two? Or we're at three?
We're all the way down to two now. Yeah, we had It and Gerald's Game at three. My number two, and I know that there are people who are going to be saying, John, what are you smoking? But my number two is Happy Death Day. And again, I've been a horror for mainstream this year. This was another 89 loop roller coaster. I loved this. People were saying, oh, it's copying Groundhog's Day. They mentioned that they're copying Groundhog Day in the movie. They totally embraced that they were doing that. They were very deliberate about doing that. And I thought that it was fun. And it's a horror comedy. And I think it did a good job of pulling you into the horror comedy. But I will be full disclosure for people who aren't all over the internet like us. A lot of people just didn't like this movie. This is one of those movies where the reviews are like 40% of the people gave it fives, 40% of the people gave it ones, and the remaining 20% are in the middle. I'm at the top. I loved it. I thought it was totally fun and engaging and very self-aware of what it was and what it was doing. So I loved Happy Death Day. I think that it's going to be a fun date night, a fun hangover movie, a fun deliberate popcorn flick, however you want to go about it. I thought it was awesome.
It did really well with – I think it did really well. It made a lot of money. I think the kids – I think a lot of teenagers loved it. The kids who don't go on Rotten Tomatoes or IMDb and vote. I think people looking for something – I don't know why, like, after watching the trailers, I don't know why you would go watch Happy Death Day, then complain that it's like Groundhog Day and not too extreme.
Don't know. Maybe people thought it copied too much. Again, I think the film knew it was and presented well that it was, but
it's a dirt cheap film that, from all accounts, featured a very likable actress.
You just said it was dirt cheap? I would have assumed this had a very, very high production value.
I mean, the nice thing is about – so I worked on a – I guess this sounds technical, but I worked on a movie called Premature. It's on Netflix. And it's this kid wakes up every morning after having a wet dream, and he has to like go through his day trying to get laid. It's like a teen sex comedy, and it's on Netflix. But the good thing is about shooting the same day is the same locations, same outfits, same kind of background. So you do explore different areas, but you do keep your sets relatively small because you're waking up in the same place and you're moving to the same locations. There's definitely some differences, but that's a very good way. Like Groundhog Day broke that mold. But if you're looking to be cheap, you wake up in the same place. You go to the same place. So it really drops a lot of the location costs down. And obviously there are some exceptions to it if they go somewhere else throughout the day. But a lot of these scenes, they can knock out like block shooting. So every shot in the house, they probably knocked out really quick. And walking to school, like just all those different things. So that's how I think they kept
all the repeated shots.
Yeah. So, I mean, you just do those. You just do take 2 days aside and knock all those out. And you don't have to worry about wardrobe. So
you didn't see this, right?
No.
What was your gut impression of the trailer? Did this strike you as something that would be fun and dumb, something that could be good, something that looked horrible? What was your gut instinct?
I thought it looked cute. I just didn't have time to go see it in a theater because when was it released? October?
I think so.
Or
October, early November.
Yeah, I think that was when my miss of when I was traveling a lot for work. So I just had no time to see it. But from all accounts, like people that I really liked in a respect had a lot of fun with this movie. You had a lot of fun with it. So
I loved it.
I kind of wish I would have went and watched it. I think there's a place in horror. See, if you and I just sat here and did five independent horror films each, this podcast, I don't know, that I think the fact that we're so varied across the board here shows that we appreciate horror as a genre.
And differently. I am responding to raw entertainment, not necessarily filmmaking. I think that you inherently gravitate towards filmmaking acuity, and I go, you know what I mean? Like we look for different things or respond to different things.
Yeah.
But good. By the way, my review of Happy Death Day was October 20th, so it definitely came out before that.
Yeah, gotcha. So I was in the midst of like the biggest show of the year, so I just couldn't go to see it. But I wish it was out now. I would love to watch it. And I don't know, I've read as much as I could. Jason, Blumhouse, he was on the Nerdist podcast. He had nothing but great things to say about the making of it. And I'm stoked to watch it.
So I just gave the most bubblegum pop top 10 horror movie probably on this list. Sure. What is your number two?
Raw, a French horror film about a student going to veterinary school and learning she has a craving for flesh. And it's I think I started reading about this movie, and the director, her name is Julia Ducorno. I wish I could pronounce it right. I am not. And I think this lady's awesome who directed Raw, because I just want to read you some of the quotes. Like it's a little longer, but I got to do it because I think she's awesome. She's like, I didn't want to glamorize anything, especially with the girl's body, she says. A body is a body. In every movie we see, women have to be beautiful and fit or whatever the hell. And they have to fit a certain box, and no woman fart, poop, pee, burp. This is why you can relate to them, because they are not these heavenly creatures, the women in the film. They are real people with real feelings, and when they go down, they go down. This is something we don't see enough of. Always in movies, when people cry, they cry like this. Like St. Mary crying. We're all equals with our bodies, so F off. She says she's inspired by David Cronenberg's handling of similar material and says she strives to explore the human condition with a lot of honesty. I could have made a gore fest with this film, but no, I wanted the audience to feel for her and to understand the title character, and it's actually being human to be like this. I have two more things left. She's fired up now. She talks about the feminist context in which the film has been placed and her aversion to being seen as a female director making female films. She references Raw's grueling bikini wax, in which the pubic hairs are ripped off in extreme close-up. The point, though, she says, the director, is that we can all feel that pain, regardless of what genitals we have. People telling me it was nice to have a woman director because it brought softness to the industry. And I was like, have you seen my movie? Did you see it? How can you say that? I'm not toilet paper. Toilet paper is soft. I'm not soft. I love this lady.
I see why people refer to the soft. A lot of her execution was brutally honest, and then there. But I think the softness wasn't meant to sound feminizing. I think it was meant to sound revelatory. I just the sisterly relationship in that, the older sister who was the upperclassman and the younger sister who is the rookie, they called it. Maybe that was just a translated term, but who was the first year veterinary student. That was at many times very, you know, contentious. Oh, you're going to make me look bad. Just do it. Just do it. While she's hazing her. Just do it. You're going to make me look bad. If you don't do it, you're going to be ridiculed. You're going to get kicked out. And then other time, it was very bro-ish, right? And then other times, it was very sensitive. But sensitive in the way that, Mark, you and I, over the years, have had arguments that got very sensitive.
But
you see what I mean? This is what I mean, right? We're two big dudes who might get loud on the phone when things get sensitive, but the sensitivity is in the emotions, not the sounds or the appearance.
I think that's
the softness that I mean, though. You know what I mean? That's what I mean.
I guess if she's looking at it, she's like, if they would have said you brought a great female perspective to it, just the way she treated the bodies and the women and their interactions, like some 40-year-old dude who wrote that script and some 50-year-old guy who directed it wouldn't have had the same kind of feeling to this. Because like in this movie, there's a scene where like these two sisters are peeing on a roof.
Oh my God.
Like, I mean, that once again, this is not a movie for the
that was the girl equivalent of frat brothers.
Yeah, and like, I just think what she brought to the sisterhood was really great. I wouldn't call it soft, but I think she just captured that really well. And I mean, there are some crazy parts in this movie, and it's just, I think it's daring. I think it felt organic. I knew a certain someone was laying on a certain road doing that kind of thing. I knew who that was. But I just liked how, I'm mumbling and I'm stuttering, but I just think it was a very well-made film that, you know, the director, I like her. She just doesn't seem like she gives a shit, and she just put a lot of work into it. And I don't know, the violence and the gore felt organic to the story. I just really dug it. I think, you watch these French films. I haven't watched Martyrs, or what's the other one with the redneck family killing people?
Oh, they're loads. You're thinking of Frontiers.
I think. Frontiers. Like they're just on a different wavelength than we are. And I just really appreciated what it was going for. I thought, I liked it. I really enjoyed Raw. I thought it was Raw.
Yeah, Raw was the movie that I love that I watched. It's – I don't know if I ever care to watch it again,
I wouldn't watch it again.
And it's hard. They're like – I can count on my hand the people who I'd recommend it to specifically. And outside of that, it would be like, I don't know if you're going to love this or hate this, but if you want to take a chance – you could, you know, it's hard to recommend, in my opinion, unless you're talking to people who just love savvy filmmaking. That's different. But people who are specifically horror fans looking for a good horror movie, regardless of filmmaking, this is hard to recommend. It's an interesting choice as a result. Like, I acknowledge this would be in my top five films of the year, but it wouldn't be in my top five horror movies of the year.
And it's tough to recommend. I think if you're
see
a
what I mean, though?
Yeah, yeah.
It's
I just it's a good film. It's a very good film. And so
you know, there are people out there. Most people use terminology like cannibal movie. Other people use contemporary or neo-contemporary something or other horror movie or pseudo horror or terms like that or new wave horror. And I even saw one article that specifically went on this rant as to how this is specifically a werewolf movie.
What?
This is specifically a werewolf movie where they never say werewolf, and it is the most accurate depiction of modern werewolf. Even though whatever. So, but I don't want to get into it too much to ruin it for people who haven't listened. But again, so you're shocked though when I say that, right? A little bit. Even if you can infer it, you're shocked when I say that.
I never thought about it.
So it's interesting. And when I watched it, a lot of things kind of came across my mind because I like comparing movies and watching other movies. So I found some zombie and cannibal and werewolf parallels. But one person at a moderately prevalent website was on a pretty serious discourse about how this is clearly the werewolf movie that no one realizes is a werewolf movie. But again, just interesting the kind of conversations that a movie like this starts.
Yeah.
Very evocative film.
Ooh, evocative. I like that.
Very evocative film. Not provocative. That's not the thing anyone wants. It's evocative. And so that was your number two.
Number two.
My number one, we already talked about a little bit, but I'm just going to round back to it. My number one was Get Out. And again, this year, not other years, this year I am a Raw Entertainment whore, but Jordan Peele did have a lot to say. And everybody from the Today Show, all the late night shows, talking to a horror filmmaker for a change, NPR, I couldn't be happier that a horror film is getting this kind of attention, even if they're calling it a social thriller or something else. That's not important to me. And I love that he's going to do more of it, even though he's such a great comedian in general. And I love him as a comedian. I've seen him for years as Key and Peele on that show. And but that's, for me, that movie was my number one. It was the movie that I thought that I knew what I was getting into, and I really didn't know what I was getting into, and I'm thrilled with what I got into.
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely the sleeper hit of 2017, and I think everything you said, anytime that horror can be taken, like Raw is not going to be on USA Today, but the fact that
it will be on is, USA Today.
Yeah, do that. But what I love, though, is, for me, it's just like Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, Rosemary's Baby. I just feel like this movie had something to say, but also was featured A-list talent. And I don't know. I just like it. This came from a, you know, he loves movies, but he also had something to say. And I think sometimes those make the best horror films. Yeah. So,
yeah, you know, we mentioned it on a discussion in a much older podcast, but Jordan Peele is a black man who has a white mother and who's married to a white woman.
Yeah.
And so like when he did this, he had interesting reactions from the white people in his family and the black people in his family. And so like when he did this, this wasn't just telling one side. This was him being the guy in the middle, kind of telling his discourse of both sides. So, like, he wasn't even picking a side, necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you have to, like, hammer home a message in every film. Like, I think you can be subtle. Like, Dawn of the Dead was a take on consumerism.
That wasn't subtle.
Yeah, I guess that was pretty bad. But I mean, he threw monsters in there, like zombies in there, and he did it intelligently. So
let me rephrase. It's not subtle by today's standards. Back then, probably was just a mall.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I just really liked, I think he handled it well. And, people are pissed off, but I think the people who are pissed off are the ones who didn't really watch it.
They're wrong.
Yeah. You're entitled to your feelings, but I think if the people who didn't like it went in there either knowing they were going to hate, like watching it knowing they were going to hate it, like they're like, oh, no, I don't want to watch this. I think if you remain closed off to it, you're not going to appreciate it. But
I am glad that you tactfully kept this far from the number one position because it meant that we talked about it twice.
That's right.
It was worthy of it. I was going to say, before you give your final thought, I was going to ask what your number one is.
The Black Goat's Daughter. And
that's a gut punch movie, by the way.
All right, so I'm gonna spoil this. So, you know, jump ahead. I don't know.
Three minutes. Three.
This movie's really simple. It was made in 2015 by Oz Perkins, the son of Anthony Perkins, who was in Psycho. And what I like about this movie are two moments in this film. So the Black Coat's Daughter revolves around Kieran Shipka of Mad Men and Lucy Boynton. They're these two kids in a boarding school. Their parents do not come to them for separate reasons, so they have to stay longer in basically an empty school with a couple nuns. And Lucy Boynton's character, the older girl, is pregnant. She has to tell her boyfriend, and she leaves Kieran Shipka, the actress, the younger one. I don't know why I can't remember her name. I should probably know her name. But so she leaves this younger girl at the school. This younger girl hears a phone call, and a bunch of events transpire, and there are some really brutal deaths and decapitations that lead to, you know, the younger girl. I should know the name. I have all these notes, but I can't think it off here. Oh, wait. Oh, Cat. Cat.
It's Cat, yep. And Rose Cat are and the Rose. Two interact.
And so Cat murders some people, decapitates them. Then she sees by a boiler, and she's like worshiping something with these three decapitated heads. But there's just, so this girl's lonely. She doesn't have many friends at the school. Her parents didn't come to get her for reasons. I mean, well, they died. And
we're still in spoiler zone for 10 minutes. And so they got killed in a car crash.
But what I like is, so after the deaths happen in the school, and I'm leaving another subset of this film, after everything happens, they bring her to the hospital because a little girl, Kat, got shot. And Kat's in a hospital, and this priest comes up to her and gives about the most mellow exorcism you'll ever see in your life. And the creature that was in her leaves. And at this point, you think that people would be happy that this girl is saved from this beast. But the girl, as this creature's going away, she just says, don't go. Like, this is a lonely girl who finally got, like, attention from something. And instead of being relieved that this chill pastor gave her a mellow exorcism, she's just like, don't go. And concurrently during this film, there's Emma Roberts who gets picked
Joan.
Up. Joan getting picked up by this husband and wife who are making this visit to this unknown's place. Turns out that Emma Roberts is older Cat. She has gotten out of a prison. She killed somebody. And she's going back to the boarding school for whatever reasons. And the really weird thing is that the parents are the parents of Rose, who was murdered. And I like the scene where she finds it out because she starts laughing. But eventually Emma Roberts kills the parents, decapitates them, takes them to the fire, which I think she wants to bring back this demon, and it doesn't happen. And at the end, it's just her alone crying, like just heartbroken that she's alone and the thing didn't come back to her. So this movie is really simple, and it sounds really terrifying from what I'm saying, but just a little girl saying, don't go. And then she's gets older and wants to bring it back and realize it doesn't happen. There's different interpretations of this film, but I just thought the way it was made, the atmosphere, the tension, the characters, the patience, I just thought it was a very good horror film that was simple. And I love it when it just, I don't know, it hit me. So that's why I put it at number one.
I'd be curious to hear a different interpretation because I saw it myself without spoilers, really, other than finding out that it was the same girl. But I thought all the same things you did. You know, I watched it on my own, all the same things you did. It sounds like you were just speaking for me when you described the movie. I will call this some kind of like Raw, but this is a little higher for me. This is probably the best film, not just horror film, the best film that I saw this year that I didn't necessarily like a lot. I agree that it's a fantastic film. I didn't dislike it, but I didn't like it. I definitely didn't love it. Didn't like it. This is an interesting thing. I never got into the characters. I love what they did with the characters, but I kind of want to see this expanded into 4 hours or a mini series to make what they presented work for me. I wanted more to get invested into those characters to understand them.
Just
or to want to care.
When that girl said, don't go, I was like, whoa.
Best line of the movie, by the way. And, agreed there. That was powerful.
Yeah, and there's some interesting interpretations. I was reading, this woman says, the following morning we see Kat. This is after Emma Roberts kills the parents of Rose. The following morning we see Kat wandering a lonely road and for the first time capable of expressing emotion. Finishing off Rose's family seems to have lifted the burden of her possession completely, and she finally confronted with the gravity of her crimes. I don't think so.
Nope, I don't see that at all.
I think she's crying. She's crying because the thing didn't come back.
This is just a person writing something. There's nothing authoritative. Not that we're right necessarily, but you know what I mean? It's just another person out there giving an opinion, and respectfully, I think it's wrong. If for no other reason, then you and I happen to have converged on what I think are the exact same thought patterns while watching a movie separately. And we have very different tastes.
And I like what the director said. He kind of confirms what we think. He said it really comes down to an end of the movie where the monster is broken and the monster has lost everything. The monster is now officially alone. And the fact that people have responded to that with, wow, I felt a bit sad for her even after everything she did. That's what the movie is about. It's about being able to sit and be with something who's awful and understand there's a sadness behind why she's awful, which is always the case. I just thought that was interesting. So at the end, at the end when she's crying because the thing didn't come back, like, I felt for this woman who decapitated people. She just wanted something. It's really interesting. Like, I've never seen a horror film like that. And actually, Megan was the one who suggested it, which is pretty awesome. And I don't know. I think it's torn. A lot of audiences really haven't liked it, but for me, just kind of the whole don't go. And at the end, Emma Roberts is really good at the end of this. I was really impressed with her. And I thought James Remar as the Rose's father and Lauren Holly were good. James Remar had a lot of warmth to him. He's like Dexter's father. Well, he is Dexter's father in Dexter, but this film was simple. I'm not saying I liked it because it was simple, but I don't know. A lot of people are reading into it, obviously. So maybe I'm not reading into it, but I thought The Black Ghost Daughter for me is number one. That's my number one film.
I thought everyone did outstanding acting jobs, and I loved all the lines they were given. I'm just going to come back to the point that I wish the scope had a step back taken so that I saw a little more before and in between of these characters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Their execution for what was delivered, however, was on point. It just, for a movie watching experience, it's one of those things. I am thrilled that I'm glad you recommended it to me. I will have difficulty recommending it to people who aren't major film buffs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a difficult movie.
Well, a lot of these movies, Devil's Candy, Raw.
They're emotionally trying movies, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're tough movies, but they, you know what? They're also the movies that crack open new eggs and bleed into new genres or ideas. And that's what we need. And I love that it was made. I love that I saw it. Not going to be on my shelf. And it's not because I don't like it.
For what it's worth. Oh, sorry. I interrupted you, dude.
No, it's not going to. No, that's all I'm saying. It's not because I don't like it. Not going to be on my shelf.
For what it's worth, I watched this movie with my wife, and she really liked it. So normally she's kind of against horror. Not, I don't know. Maybe I've just made her watch too many films like Thirst and I Saw the Devil and Raw. But she really enjoyed Black Coat's Daughter. And I'm not – it's just – I don't know. I'm saying I don't know and huh a lot. I just like the simplicity of it, but I think simple's not easy. And I think this film could have been messed up in many ways. So I like the simplicity, but I also appreciate all the hard work behind the camera that Oz Perkins did to create such a neat tone, which is tough. So that's my number one.
Fair. Your number one. We got Black Coat's Daughter and Get Out. So folks, if you haven't seen them, maybe you should see him if you fancy yourself a horror connoisseur.
If we're going with, like, our top five, Get Out's the overall winner, then. Because we both put in our top five and no other films.
Could be, yeah.
All right, so Get Out is the overall winner. If Movies, Films, and Flicks had to sit here right now, would we be happy with Get Out being our consensus one?
I think so. I'd be very content with that.
All right, cool. So you heard our picks here, and our consensus one is Get Out. And, yeah,
And Jordan Peele, if you're listening, we will gladly accept free plane flights to the set of your next movie that you're doing, so we can review it for you. Of course, if you're listening, Jordan Peele, just saying.
And you want to hear something kind of random? The movie was supposed to be set in California, but they lost the location rights like 2 weeks before filming. So Jason Blum had to call Jordan Peele and be like, "Hey, man, we're going to Alabama." but this movie was shot in like, 20 days, so it wasn't too bad being away. But I just thought that was an interesting tidbit about Get Out.
Well, we have rounded, we've enlightened people. We've shared a lot of opinions. I think it's time for us to share plugs. People who we care about. Yeah. Do you have any plugs for us this week, Mark?
Hank Kaminsky.
Who is Hank Kaminsky?
Or was it Hank Jablonski? The character actor who plays Jerky Sons in many movies and won't make us angry at Ethan Embry. I'd really like to give him a shout out to Hank Jablonski.
That's fair. Hey, for people who stumbled across us by means that I wouldn't even predict, because we're on some strange apps. Mark, where can you find our podcast?
Blog Talk Radio Podcast. Which one do I use? Podcast, we should be, I'm making moves to get us on Google. We're on Podcast Addict. We're on iTunes. We're also a few other places that I noticed, but I don't know their names.
So I've actually been shocked by some of the places that I've seen us show up that I hadn't heard of. So we're also, we have our Movies, Films, and Flicks with an X, of course, Facebook page. We have at Movies, Films, Flicks on Twitter. We have Just for the Horror at MFF for Movies, Films, and Flicks Horror Corner. And I've got a couple plugs as well, other than Cigar City. Mark, do you have any others?
Yeah, and also, guys, we need your questions. Also, rate, subscribe, review the pod. We'd love to hear what you think. The more rate, reviews, and subscribers we have, the higher we are on iTunes, which means the closer we get to getting Cigar City to sponsor us, which means our podcast will be incoherent.
Because we'll be full of their beer.
But, wait, that's not good. Drink in moderation, people. All right, let's get the plugs over.
So I wanted to send out a thanks to David Koenig, who is at A Fiend on Film on Twitter. He has a quarterly horror zine that he puts out. I was in his last quarterly installment, and I'm in his upcoming horror installment on David Cronenberg's films. So he puts this together as a labor of love and distributes it at horror cons. I think it's wonderful what he does. And also I wanted to thank at Real Jilly G on Twitter. That's Jilly Gibson, who's at www.crimsonquintessence.com. Wonderful writer, very supportive of our material on media. Very appreciative of her. She's a horror aficionado. Good co-promoter, wonderful person. So I'm very grateful, both of our supporters. We support you back, and let's horrify more people together.
Ooh. Watch Black Ghost Daughter.
I got nothing else.
you had a really good buy last week, and I messed it up. So, you know, guys.
You know the problem with my closing lines is that I never really know if I'm giving a closing line or not.
All right, well, how about this? Thank you guys for everything for myself and John Levengood. This is Movies, Films, and Flicks. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you next week.